Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to the podcast. My name is Gabrielle Love. I am your host. We've got an incredible person with us today. I cannot wait to hear about all of the research. And actually, in fact, what I'm most interested in is all of the various applications that he has come across in his research for psychedelics or plants, anything in that realm. Without further ado, Dr. Ivan Castleman, welcome to the podcast. Feel free to introduce yourself.
Amazing. Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be on your podcast. My name is Dr. Ivan Castleman. I'm the chief psychedelic officer for Haven Life. It's a psychedelic mushroom company based in Vancouver. I did all my graduate and postgraduate training in psychedelic medicine. So well versed in the research angle, and then spent quite a bit of time when I was younger researching psychedelics in a more experiential way as well. So lots of experience there as well. So looking forward to having a chat with you.
That's great. Well, thanks for joining us. Correct me if I'm wrong, some of your research specialized in ethnobotany. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, that was my sort of first step into graduate training. So I've got a graduate training in ethnobotany and ethnopharmacology, and it's still kind of my first true research love. That's kind of what's framed a lot of my psychedelic research over the last decade.
That's great. Maybe we can start with some of the findings from your research in that particular field and maybe some of the exciting findings.
Okay. Absolutely. So I did, all my graduate and postgraduate work in ethnobotany. And I think, okay, first, yeah, the plant that I focused on was a plant called Salvia divinorum.
Yep.
It's a short-acting hallucinogen used traditionally in Mexico.
Yeah.
So I did, extensive work on a variety of different aspects. The first sort of foray into the ethnobotany world that I did was looking at the use patterns of Salvia divinorum, because the use patterns actually differ quite substantially between traditional use and modern use.
Interesting.
So it is really interesting because same plant, same active compound, but humans are very, very ingenious when it comes to figuring out ways to do things. So traditionally, Salvia divinorum, which is used in the in Oaxaca, Mexico, by the curanderos and curanderas there, they typically take a large number of leaves and they masticate it over about 20 or 30 minutes. So they basically just chew it and chew it and chew it and chew it in their mouth, and that actually brings up the salvinorin A is the active compound that makes us causes the psychedelic effect. Mm-hmm. in salvia. It's actually really interesting because it's the only known psychoactive diterpene, whereas most of the time we're getting we're getting that activity from alkaloids.
Mm-hmm.
The modern use, so people have figured out that they can soak the leaves in a certain type of solvent.
Yep.
And then they can fortify more leaves with that solvent. And so as the solvent evaporates, it concentrates the active ingredient, and then you can smoke that. And then when you smoke it, it's a very short-acting, very intense, disassociative, hallucinogenic experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got such a high variability. So it's a very, very interesting compound to work with.
Mm-hmm. Is it a longer experience with the more traditional use?
Yes. So it's less intense and longer. So typically when you chew it, you're looking at something in the neighborhood of like 2 to 3 hours as far as the experience goes. Whereas when you smoke salvia, it's typically done in less than 15 minutes.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Do you know anything about the solvent that you mentioned?
Typically it's acetone, which is a pretty average one. I mean, it's in everything from, you know, nail polish remover, all the way through to like industrial stuff. But yeah, it's not a very interesting solvent, but that seems to be the one that pulls the salvinorin A out of the plant material the best.
Gotcha. Great. Okay, so you start off with this work, you know, during your graduate studies. So how does this lead into what you do next? Walk us through the sort of progression of your career.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, the like my master's in ethnobotany and my research in ethnopharmacology, you know, both of those were sort of science-based degrees, but the ethno in the ethnobotany still considers the human usage and you know, human use patterns and that sort of thing. For my postgraduate work, I delved into more of just like the very hardcore science. So same compound or same plant rather, Salvia divinorum, but this time I looked at population genetics as well as the analytical chemistry of the plant. So in the genetic side of things, I took samples from all over the world of Salvia divinorum. Back when I was doing my research, Salvia divinorum could be obtained just by going into a shop and you know, a lot of like head shops mm-hmm. and stuff would just sell it. I know in Canada now that's not allowed anymore. And I know that in several US states, it's also not allowed. And then in the UK where I started my research, it's also not allowed anymore. So things have changed a little bit since I did my research. But yeah, back in the day, you could buy samples. So I bought a whole bunch of samples from around the world, and I tested them for a few known markers in Salvia as well as a few known markers in the genus. And the super interesting finding there is that I didn't find any genetic variation in the plant wow. at all. Yeah, and you would expect at least a little bit of genetic variation, but the story really is that in the mid-60s, a researcher and ecologist named Sterling Bunnell went to Mexico, collected the plant, brought it back to UC Davis, and that one UC Davis collection basically ended up populating all of the salvia that's now in the world outside of Mexico.
Gotcha.
So salvia is a really interesting plant because its sexual reproduction is actually very, very limited. And it's typically you would take a cutting and then you can root the cutting. So it's very, very easy to clone and multiply like that. So it's not totally unexpected that there's no genetic variation, but it was unusual. We were hoping to find at least a little bit. And then on the chemistry side of things, I didn't actually dive in too much into the psychoactive compounds mm-hmm. found in salvia because so the salvinorins, which is that's the class of molecules that are hold salvinorin A. I mean, it goes A, B, C, D, F, G, H, I, J. Like there's a lot of salvinorins. I focused rather on other known compounds that would be found in the genus, and ended up finding rosmarinic acid, which hadn't been. It's a fairly common compound found in salvias, mm-hmm. but it was the first time that somebody had documented it in Salvia divinorum. So that was interesting.
Gotcha. I mean, I've got more questions about this particular thing, but I really do want to hear more about where you're at now. First of all, so you mentioned, so I live in Canada, and I do awesome. Remember yeah. a decade, well, maybe 12, 13 years ago, I could go to a local convenience store and pick up some salvia. And that wasn't a big deal. Now, of course, over time that changed, which you've mentioned as well. So what happened? Was there research that discovered something that, you know, made it a little bit more dangerous, a bit more risk? Why is it now suddenly not allowed?
Yeah, well, typically governments work at a glacial pace when it comes to this kind of stuff. And my hypothesis is that the use patterns weren't, that, or weren't to the point where enough people were using it for the government to worry about. But you know, the war on drugs is still a real kind of going concern in our society. So you know, officious government officials, they get onto something and they're like, no, this can't happen. You know, we couldn't possibly have people, you know, opening their minds and, you know, healing through, you know, psychedelic experience or anything like that. So, yeah, I just put it up to officious government officials and politicians making poor decisions,
right.
I guess.
Right.
As far as safety goes, you know, psychedelics, like classical psychedelics, are very, very, very safe, in that they do not cause physical addiction. And, you know, when we're in a, you know, barring any serious mental health issues, you know, most healthy adults can, you know, easily take psychedelics, providing they're in a good, the set and setting, of course, is always important. But yeah, psychedelics are almost as safe as you can get as far as taking
Gotcha. So did you always have an interest in psychedelics, or did that just sort of happen?
No. This was a very, very early thing that happened in my life. Interesting. Again, it all sort of surrounds the war on drugs propaganda machine. So when I was in high school, the going discourse was, this is your brain on drugs, you know, really sort of like trying to whip up the fear and the, you know, basically a fear and misinformation campaign that existed all the way from the, you know, the late 70s onwards. So we all, yeah, and all of us have been inundated with this war on drugs propaganda machine. And so I kind of got the idea that I wasn't being told the whole truth. And at the same time, you know, my dad was a computer studies teacher. And so I had access, early access to the internet and early access to, you know, a lot of the early content that was on the internet around, you know, psychedelics and cannabis and that sort of thing. And always be grateful to my father. I'm sure he would have not been impressed that I was on those message boards and reading all those interesting stuff. But right from the very beginning, you know, I kind of understood that there was some potential or something in all of this that I wasn't being told the whole truth. So it just made me more curious. And so, you know, as a young person, you know, I learned a lot. And then, you know, as I got older, I got access to some of these compounds and started to, you know, experience them. And yeah, I guess
the rest is history. Indeed. Okay. So let's fast forward to now. What's your area of focus now?
So right now, my primary function is basically as a master mycologist for Haven. So over the last 2 years, we've developed a business plan around bringing psychedelic medicine to patients, particularly in Canada, but also globally. And so last year, I spent the majority of the year in Jamaica setting up our cultivation facility there. So we now have a fully functional mushroom growing facility in Jamaica, and that's where we produce all of our mushrooms. But you know, there's a lot of work to do to get that sorted. I had to stabilize a number of strains of mushrooms to make sure that they were, you know, good quality and they were going to be sufficient for growing and, you know, large scale production, and then design the lab and manage all the logistics of getting all my lab equipment to Jamaica. And then I was really, really blessed to have an incredible team on the ground in Jamaica. We all kind of put our heads together and, you know, I train them up on the skill set that I had, and then they've taken it from there. That's basically been my day-to-day, is just managing the cultivation facility and making sure that, you know, our quality and our standards are very, very high.
That sounds great. So you mentioned, classic psychedelics. I'm wondering, of all the classic psychedelics that are out there, and obviously there are a number that are being actively used, or at least in the process of becoming actively used in, for medicinal purposes. I'm wondering why the focus on mushrooms, why the focus on mycology?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So when we were developing the sort of the business idea and the go public strategy for Haven, we did sort of take a look at basically all of the classic hallucinogens to see, where we might want to focus our attention. Mm-hmm. We zeroed in on mushrooms. My personal experience, because I've been a hobby mycologist, I guess that would be a good apt description for the last 20 years. I've always, I've spent a lot of time hiking in the forest in British Columbia and working in the forest in British Columbia and, growing mushrooms at home and just being really interested in mushrooms. So that definitely inspired us in that direction. But as far as regulatory framework goes, especially in Canada, we use the early days of the cannabis industry as kind of a template to see, how we were going to, basically how we could make good hypotheses on how the government would handle the implementation of a regulatory framework around psychedelics. And, mushrooms are, they're fairly easy to grow. And once you've grown and dried them, they're basically ready to go. So there's not a lot of processing and all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It is a traditional medicine. So there is, use patterns that, predate any kind of European involvement in North America, particularly in sort of the Mexico region. Mm-hmm. We felt like, when it comes to regulations and politicians and bureaucrats, they're very conservative. They don't like the cutting edge. They don't like anything new. So we felt that, mushrooms and cannabis were similar enough that wouldn't get, that group of people really anxious or worried, that it could be a nice, smooth, easy transition into psychedelic medicine with magic mushrooms. So that Gives it a bit of insight on our thinking as to why we wanted to use psychedelic mushrooms.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, it definitely seems like a race between MDMA and psilocybin. Those seem to be going head to head.
100%. And I think both of them have really, really good use cases. Right now we talk about psychedelic medicine and that, as a category, and then we list all these things that it could be good for, PTSD, treatment-resistant depression, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think as we are able to expand our research and access more patients and collect more data, I think what we're going to find is that, maybe psilocybin has a really good use case for a certain type of indication, whereas MDMA, for a different type of indication. I think what I'm really excited about in the next 5 to 10 years is the therapeutic protocols that are being developed around certain psychedelics and B, certain indications. And I think that as we get farther into that research, we're going to see a place for all of these classic psychedelics to help out. Obviously not all in the same indication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sure there's quite I think we've got a long way to go before we've got sort of a plethora of options there. Specifically with regulations, that's probably going to take longer than we think. But you mentioned that's one of the things that you're excited about. What else are you excited about?
I don't know. I'm excited in general about the future of psychedelic medicine. Mm-hmm. We've been through a few waves of interest in psychedelics, even in my own lifetime. But as a society, four or five times we've kind of like come to the precipice of society accepting psychedelics as a possible medicine and that sort of thing, and then not really got there. So I think now you know, the ball is definitely rolling. We've got this momentum. You know, there's dozens of you know, public and private companies that are sort of driving the commercial charge. We've got some great organizations like MAPS that have been working tirelessly to, you know, align society on the benefits. And then, you know, lots of different charities and nonprofits. I guess MAPS a nonprofit as well, but you know, just a lot of organization, like I think a lot of groups coming together and understanding that, you know, everyone has a place in sort of psychedelic medicine going forward, and we all have to, you know, pull together and hopefully we can make this into an extraordinary thing. I'd honestly like to see you know, full recognition of our cognitive sovereignty in Canada, and just, you know, be able as an adult be able to access, you know, a safe supply of any of the compounds that I choose to, you know, to take and to improve my life. But I think we're still a long way from that. I think the psychedelic medicine thing is the tip of the spear. We really need to understand what it can do. We really prove that it's safe and that it's not going to have a detrimental effect on society.
Mm-hmm. And that it's not going to have long-term effects on someone's brain or, you know, mental health. Or, I mean, do you, you know, from your research, from what you know so far, have we proven that yet?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question and difficult to prove. But the way that psychedelics work, psychedelics basically target neurotransmitters that already exist in our body. So it's not like we're doing anything new that our metabolism kind of doesn't know about or is surprised about. It does kind of excite those neurotransmitters in specific ways for certain lengths of time. So it certainly does, just like going for running a marathon is, mm-hmm. For your muscles, you know, the taking psychedelics is a fairly similar activity, you know, as far as your metabolism goes for your mind and that sort of area of your metabolism. So, it doesn't really have a detrimental effect on your brain. That's really war on drugs propaganda again. Whereas, you know, something like alcohol, there's no neurotransmitters in our body for alcohol. The alcohol derives its effect because our liver can't process it fast enough. So the blood alcohol level rises and basically, yeah, we get drunk because our body can't eliminate the alcohol fast enough. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want to maintain and improve your brain health, you should stop drinking. Do more psychedelics.
Yeah, I love that you bring that example for comparison. That's absolutely right. And not enough people really acknowledge the effects of alcohol on the brain, on the body. It's just it's overall just not a great thing to ingest.
Yeah, no, I agree. I used to have a considerable problem with alcohol back in the day, and now have not drank anything for almost 12 years now. So, you know, I can definitely attest to its negative effect on the body, and I can also attest to how much better it is when mm-hmm. I don't drink. I know that other people have different relationships with alcohol. I didn't manage mine very well, so I'm glad to be done with it. But we kind of accept it as a default in our society without really considering the effects. Somebody whose opinion that I respect a lot, he uses salt also as an example. And if salt went in front of the FDA in the US today, it wouldn't be approved for sale just because of its effect on the body and all that kind of stuff. And then, yeah, tobacco is probably another story as well. But there's an important ceremonial and cultural aspect to tobacco. So I don't like to bring that one up as much in this context. But we all choose our libation of choice, right? And yeah, we can't sit around and drink water all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Right? But I do love that you also brought up salt. I had no idea that salt was that bad. I mean, that makes it sound significantly worse than I thought. But you know, well, that's a story for another day.
Yeah. Agree.
Salt's not good for you. So I have a curious question, but before I get to that, mm-hmm. I just want to dive a bit deeper into sort of your perspective on the psychedelic industry and all of the effects, the potential, all that stuff. Do you have any concerns so far?
Yeah, I mean, my big concern is that I think there's too many psychedelic companies out there. Mm. You know, I've had the privilege to meet, you know, a lot of the leadership team from many, many different psychedelic companies, both public and private. And it's amazing that people are really, you know, putting their heads together and creating these amazing, you know, business ideas and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, especially in the public markets realm, the investment isn't there yet because the regulations aren't there yet. And, you know, smart investors aren't going to be investing in, you know, public companies until there's a clear path to revenue. So, the real sticking point right now is the fact that, you know, governments are dragging their feet and not sort of progressing the regulatory framework fast enough. So that would be one of my concerns. My other concern is that having been through the sort of the churn in the rise of the cannabis industry, there's a lot of, you know, capital markets types that are into these different psychedelic projects, not because they believe in the medicine, but they think that there's a fast dollar to be made. And that's difficult because their expectations will never be met because there's not a fast dollar in this. We have a lot of work to do. We have a lot of, you know, participation. You know, Haven as a company, you know, we understand that we have to make sure we maintain and improve our shareholder value, but at the same time, you know, we understand that a lot of that is going to derive from making sure that we're, you know, participating in the industry and we're helping it grow and collaborating. So we're actually collaborating with Vancouver Island-based organization called Theracil. Theracil's been doing amazing work helping patients get Section 56s and different licensing for the use of psychedelics and matching them with practitioners and stuff. So, you know, we're kind of lending our support to them and really trying to maximize what we can do with the special access program here in Canada. So we all have a lot of work to do. And unfortunately for the fast money investors, they're not going to be super happy with the psychedelic industry. Not for a while. Mm-hmm.
One of the things you have been mentioning is sort of the traditional use cases for psychedelics. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on maybe the role that you think more traditional uses or traditional approaches need to play in the sort of industry if this does become, you know, a sort of easier to access part of our medicine establishment, or, you know, if you have any thoughts around the role that needs to play or doesn't need to play, or the impact of there being absolutely no connection to sort of the origins of a lot of these psychedelics.
Yeah, it's a really good question and a veritable minefield, I will admit. As an ethnobotanist, one of my early mentors in university, her name is Nancy Turner. She's Canada's foremost ethnobotanist, and through her education and training and her mentorship, as well as, you know, as I've sort of progressed through my research and my understanding of psychedelics, I have a very deep respect for the traditional or indigenous use of psychedelics. I think that without those very, very early citizen scientists, you know, thousands of years ago, we would not have access or an understanding of a lot of these compounds. So I think that we, you know, as a society, as an industry, we owe a lot of what we do to those indigenous cultures and those indigenous practices, and they deserve a lot of our respect and admiration for doing so. Being that I really like psychedelic use patterns, I typically mm-hmm. sort of explain our psychedelic use patterns in three broad categories. Mm-hmm. So the first category is like a traditional, I like to call it spiritual, but there's, again, the labels are difficult to label things, but that traditional use, we have the medical or the therapeutic mm-hmm. use, and then we have a free form use. So the traditional and the medical, they're both they're both boxes. There's patterns in there. There's ways of doing them, SOPs mm-hmm. per se. Whereas the free form is a little bit more open. So with the traditional, we hear a lot about cultural appropriation and that sort of thing, and that does happen to a degree. But I think that my early training, both with like ayahuasca mushrooms as well as peyote, were all done within a more traditional mm-hmm. context. So that really allowed me to, understand that those ceremonies from a traditional perspective. And I think it's very, very valuable for people to undertake those experiences. And I really hope that those types of practices are preserved and then future generations get to experience those traditional ways of knowing, basically. The cultural appropriation thing is hard because humans are very inquisitive and very intelligent. And when we meet other humans that have something that's different than what we have and that can, expand our experience and expand our knowledge, we tend to kind of glom onto those and want to know more about it and all that kind of stuff. So, the spread of any knowledge, but psychedelic knowledge in particular, is, the story of human knowledge expansion and curiosity and interest.
Mm-hmm.
So going forward, I think that companies that don't kind of use the traditional use patterns as at least a foundation for going forward, I think we'll have problems. I think that all of the companies we should be looking at that. I'm of European descent, so I don't really want to, I don't think it's my place to jump, feet first into it all, but I'm definitely an advocate and an ally and would definitely stand shoulder to shoulder to preserve that traditional knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I would be curious to see, because you mentioned, you've got these two are boxes, one is just sort of free form. I'd be curious to know about some of the ways that maybe you've thought of or others have thought of to integrate some of the different elements from those two different boxes, be it the traditional and then the medical. So if you've got a therapeutic model, say you go into a clinic, how would you bring in elements from a more traditional or indigenous sort of approach to using the psychedelic?
Yeah, well, it's certainly possible to have, a combination of approaches. I think that you do also have to look at the intended result of the psychedelic experience. And in a medical or a therapeutic context, typically what you want to do is you want to limit as many variables as you can so that the practitioner can really dive into the patient's personal, mm-hmm. Issues, I guess. There's probably a better word for that, but, and really focus in on the individual. Whereas I feel when I'm in a ceremonial situation, like it's an individual experience, but experienced in a collective. I think that, we talk a lot about integration, and integration has been part of the psychedelic experience since there has been psychedelics. So I think that, that's a key component, and it doesn't necessarily have to be attached to a particular, psychedelic use pattern. I think everyone, if you do psychedelics, you should be integrating, because that's the most important part of a psychedelic experience. Mm-hmm. I do know that as more and more practitioners get trained, both in the more of a spiritual traditional context as well as a medical one. I know that you know there's some you know trip sitters and stuff that are a little bit more orientated in the traditional, but are starting to help therapists out. And I think that this is really important, especially when there is a cultural context to the therapy, right? Like, you know, I think we all come from different cultures and societies, so sometimes you got to fine tune the therapy to account for the cultural aspects as well as the personal aspects in their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of that makes sense. So here's my question. It's sort of just a curious question. You'd mentioned the mind at some point, and I'd love to hear just your perspective on what the mind is, what the mind is in general, and also what the mind is in reference to the body.
Yeah, a very, very excellent question. The mind is an extraordinary thing. Like humans I think we don't realize sometimes how lucky we are to have, basically have a supercomputer rolling around on our shoulders, right? Like, I mean, it is an extraordinary, extraordinary thing. And the mind is, something that's always fascinated me because I've always quested to have to maximize my mental capacity. So it's something that psychedelics has really helped me explore. So when I was in my early 20s, I studied under an ayahuasca lineage that through those experiences, my life, my worldview changed, 180 degrees, totally different from, when I went in. And a lot of it had to do with the mind. And because before, I grew up in a, middle-class BC, very, scientific orientated family. So, the brain and the body, we're a self-contained entity. And, beyond what's in our brain, we collect things and put it in our brain, but by no means do we have any sort of otherworldly connection. Mm-hmm. We're just individuals walking around doing our own thing. What I saw when I was, or when I experienced and what I integrated after my ayahuasca experiences, we have our brain, but I think, our mind is much more, it has way more capacity than we allow it or we give it, And I think that, there is, potential for all sorts of interesting things that we see on movies and shows and stuff like that. But at the very least, we definitely have the capacity to, connect to a collective consciousness. There's definitely things beyond our everyday waking state. So our body basically during our everyday waking state, we wake up, we're sober and all that kind of stuff. Our brain actually limits our sensory input to its very minimum. The very, very minimum that we need for survival is what we input every day. You take psychedelics, kind of opens up the sides, we import more, we're all of a sudden exposed to a lot more information even coming in, let alone, than what our mind can do in terms of, collective consciousness and all of that sort of thing. So, I mean, what we know about the human mind maybe know 1 or 2% of what it actually can accomplish and actually what it is. So it's pretty exciting because, that means the future is full of could potentially be full of extraordinary discoveries if we, as a society, if we choose to put our time and effort into it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think it's definitely, I'm personally very fascinated by it. In particular, I'm fascinated by it because it's not something that's very easy to kind of pinpoint and define and put in a box, because we can pretty much measure lots of things in our bodies. But the mind is sort of, it's this thing that, we are actively experiencing, you know, we're actively identifying with, and yet we can't quite measure it. And that's where, you know, science, if you're kind of looking at it from a scientific perspective, it's really hard to grapple with this idea of something that you just can't measure.
Exactly. It's a Schrodinger's cat kind of scenario where, you know, you can measure something, but by measuring it or observing it, you change the, you know, you change what you're, the data that you're collecting. It's it's an extraordinary thing. It kind of spins your brain up if you think about it too much, but
it really does. It really does. Yeah. So here's a challenge for you. If you were to give us a sort of a general, you know, broad stroke definition of the mind in one sentence, what would that be?
Oh, wow. Definition of the mind. I guess I would something about, I would call it something like a vessel for collective human potential or something like that.
Interesting. Fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. I might refine that if I had a little bit more time, but I think that would be a good start.
Yeah. Yeah. Right on. Well, now you've got something to work on in the event that someone else asks you to define it.
I always love something to ponder on. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you mentioned, you know, in your early 20s, you studied under an ayahuasca lineage. Did you then go on to any other lineages, or was that the bulk of it for you?
Well, the ayahuasca lineage was definitely one of the, definitely a key component to, you know, to becoming the person that I am now. And it was a very, very important, learning for me, especially mm-hmm. at that young age. I've also done sort of traditional ceremonies, I guess, as far as mushrooms go, mm-hmm. I guess it was a sort of Mexican traditional ceremony there. And then, I've also done peyote in a traditional context as well, the Native American church. So, mm-hmm. A few of things. And then, you know, just been exposed to a lot of really amazing, people that, you know, are traditional medicine healers and practitioners and stuff like that. And that's been, maybe not necessarily studying with them, but just being exposed to them and learning from their wisdom and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So it really does sound like all of these have had a tremendous impact on you. What was that because of the perspective shifts that happened as a result, or were there other things that you experienced that really contributed to you changing?
I think, you know, a lot of it, you know, some of it has to do with the way that it affects my mental state, having, you know, suffered from sort of depressive cycles in my life and that kind of stuff. Like, I know personally how, you know, how a psychedelic experience can kind of, you know, cleanse my soul and help my mental state and, you know, help me perform at a kind of a maximum. Mm-hmm. That's really, that's really at the core of why I'm doing this. You know, I'm helping start psychedelic businesses and stuff because, you know, I was lucky to never have any sort of like major serious mental health issues, but you know, we all come with minor mental health issues. we don't have a choice. That's part of being human. Mm-hmm. So just seeing the potential in my, seeing the effects in my own life, you know, that really made me realize the potential of this medicine. And it's really driven me forward to want to help, you know, society maximize itself by getting this medicine to the people. And, you know, that's sort of mm-hmm. the underpinning, you know, modus operandi for Haven is medicine to the people. It turns out it's a little harder than just saying it, but, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a scientist through and through. I love science. I live by the scientific method. I've done a lot of different types of research and worked with, you know, amazing scientists along the way. Sometimes the societal sort of presentation of science misses the point a little bit and makes it seem very, very structured and very, very sort of like almost like anti-spirituality almost. But you mm-hmm. take some of the greatest scientists in the world world, and they'll, you know, their awe and wonder, you know, is explained to a point by science, and then when a good scientist gets to the unexplainable, then, you know, they strive for that understanding, but they're more than happy to say, well, we don't know yet. So it's unknown. It's, you know, and, you know, the unknown is extraordinary place because, yeah, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what it is. But I think that psychedelics has given me a strong, like, spiritual core to live my life by, you know, and it, I think with a strong spiritual core, you know, along with it comes a good moral direction and a, you know, a good sense of ethics, and, you know, it's a really good foundation because you don't know what's going to happen. You know, what happens when we die? What happens, you know? And, you know, I think that religion, you know, if you take religion at its core meaning and drop away the, you know, the societal and the political effects of it, I think that, you know, almost all religions in the world, you know, there's a structure for people to be good people, you know, and create community and, you know, help each other and all that kind of stuff. So not being overly religious myself, I definitely the psychedelics has definitely helped me, you know, establish and really understand my spiritual core.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. And I'm sure, you know, for someone else, psychedelics might have brought about some other sort of thing that maybe they needed or was really useful for them.
Yeah, I like to describe psychedelics as an intuitive medicine. And, you know, it's, I always tell people when they're doing psychedelics for the, you know, the first time or the first few times, or whatever, that it's really great to set an intention. I think that's sort of a very common thread and a very good advice to people that are doing psychedelics for the first time. But having done psychedelics a number of times, I can I understand that, you know, that intention often doesn't play out exactly how you think it's going to play out. You know, the medicine knows what you need and will give you, and it actually won't ever give you more than you can handle it at a time. But occasionally you get what some people call bad trips. They're difficult trips. I don't like to call them bad trips because the quintessential quote unquote bad trip, the ones that I've had, I always come back and after integrating these experiences, they're actually the most powerful and the most meaningful and they help me the most. So, so we have to put a lot of trust in the medicine and, really, you know, we can set intentions, we can make sure our setting is good, but after that, we shift over to the passenger seat, we let the compounds drive, and you know, it's all about your frame of mind, but, you know, you will almost never have an experience that's not meaningful and doesn't help you.
I love that. You know, what's funny, hearing you say, after that, we shift over into the passenger seat and let the compounds, like, I can't remember the last time I did that. I personally have so much of a, I kind of show up wanting to control as much of the experience as possible and not in a, you know, not in a desperate way or in a way where I need that control. It's more like, oh, you know, let's see what I can do with this, you know, under the influence of this. How much can I push the boundaries of my own mind and my own experience? So in that sense, I try to be in the driver's seat as much as possible, but probably I'm not in the driver's seat at all.
Yeah, well, and often, like, there's definitely different, you know, dosages, right? Like, you know, the microdose, you know, that same as you, that really allows me to kind of be in the driver's seat and control, and I, you know, I love, you know, microdosing mushrooms, I love what it does to my creativity and my drive and all that, or, you know, just creating new things and new ideas. But yeah, every once in a while, you've got to take a threshold dose and kind of let the medicine do its thing. But it's difficult, like, we live in a world where we're trained to be in control, right? We're trained, you know, to get, you know, school and university, got to always have the right answers. You know, you got to do this, you got to do that. You always got to be in control. And then in our working world, you know, we're always, you know, we manage people or we have to kind of control our jobs. We have to show up at 8 o'clock every day for work and all that stuff, right? So, so we're inundated with it. So it's difficult, I think, for a lot of people to just let something else take control. And I mean, yeah, it's not like you give up all control, right? You know, the passenger still tunes in the radio, looks at the map. You know, a passenger is not necessarily a passive role, but yeah, when we learn to kind of let go and, you know, let the compounds take hold and take us where they want to go, you know, it's, yeah, you're always presented with very interesting realizations and learning outcomes.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious if we can just backtrack for a moment, you know, the difficult trips. Are there any indications of maybe the way someone's body is reacting to the psychedelic that has been ingested that then maybe causes a difficult trip? Or is it really completely just a sort of a perceptive experience?
I think that there's definitely both. There's definitely a physiological... I mean, the better the drugs, the worse they're going to make you feel. They're going to make you throw up. They're going to make you feel nauseous. They're going to, you know... they all taste horrible, you know, so there's definitely a lot of physiology involved. And I've actually experienced somebody, you know, they didn't like the taste of mushrooms. Mm-hmm. So right from the very beginning, that sort of like initiated, you know, an uncomfortable experience for them, mm-hmm. because it was an uncomfortable physical experience. Mm-hmm. In my experience, what I find is that physical tends to drop away after the first 20 minutes, half an hour, just because we're on to something, you know, as we kind of level up the psychedelic experience, that physical component seems less and less important. Mm. And, you know, the nausea dies away. You have a drink of water and wash the taste out of your mouth. So, I mean, you can get over that. But on occasion, it'll definitely trigger an experience. But, you know, maybe that's what the medicine wants to tell you. Like, I mean, if you're got an upset stomach, maybe you shouldn't have had 10 burgers yet last night. Maybe you should have had a nice, you know, light snack and a drink of water, right? So, and then as far as the, you know, the sort of the more, you know, the mental experience, mm-hmm. that's, you know, that's multifaceted. I don't think humans are even close to understanding, you know, our mental state and the full effects of it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that it'll be interesting to learn more about that in the future. But
So another thing I'm curious about. So in terms of, you know, your focus right now is mycology, psilocybin. I'm wondering. Let's stick to that for example. In terms of growing mushrooms and producing them, and you know, selling them at mass. Is there any reason to be concerned about the chemical structure of the mushrooms? Is there any room for manipulation there when growing the mushrooms, or is it just really straightforward?
Yeah, so I guess, I mean, there's always the conversation about genetics versus epigenetics. You know, the genetics of the mushroom have been, you know, the main psychedelic mushroom that everyone uses is called Psilocybe cubensis. It originated in sort of the Caracan region, but spread all the way through, you know, sort of Central America, you know, the Central America region, so Mexico all the way through to, you know, Colombia and that sort of part of the world. And then, you know, but it's also in Asia, and there's been mushrooms exported to Australia as well. And, you know, so humans have been using these mushrooms for a long, long, long time. And so in terms of if you just simply grow the mushroom, there's not a lot of concern there, because the mushroom doesn't create Psilocybe cubensis doesn't create any overly toxic compounds or anything. Now, as we create a commercial industry, and we've seen this already in the black market, but as we create a sort of a regulated supply chain, which is what Haven is largely sort of focused on, a lot of the aspects that we've been dealing with over the last 2 years have been with quality control. So these are sort of epigenetics, right? So we want to make sure that our, you know, our strains are stabilized and they don't have any pathogens or anything like that. So we've been, you know, testing for that. You know, we want to make sure we've got a consistent, psilocybin and psilocin, which are the two active ingredients, and just making sure that it's a lot about consistency and quality control now. So that's definitely in the black market. We've seen a lot of that. You know, there's a lot of people that still grow these mushrooms using poo, basically, so like horse or cow or something like that, and that comes along with a whole bunch of issues as far as contamination goes. And if you don't quite get your sterilization right, you know, you can get mass contamination, especially when you're growing all these, because all of our mushrooms are grown in a lab, so we have to make sure that our grow rooms are controlled and cleaned on a regular basis and stuff like that. And some of this stuff doesn't happen in the black market. So illegal growing mushrooms, illegally grown mushrooms, can come with some major quality control issues, not necessarily the genetics of the mushrooms, but, you know, the environment that it grew up in and you know, the things that are around it. So it's going to be a huge, it's a huge concern for Haven, and one that we spend a lot of time, you know, developing SOPs and ensuring that, because we want our mushrooms to go from mycelium all the way through to the patient, and you know, to be able to track all that and quality control all that. So I think that those are going to be some sort of big points where, you know, all the companies that are doing what we're doing are going to have to focus on, because nobody's written manuals or SOPs about this, right? Like, it's a brand new industry. We've got to kind of invent it as we go along.
Well, I hope you all do a good job of that. That way we can all purchase and consume mushrooms in a safe way. In addition to that, so just to clarify, because, you know, you have brought up some of the issues that come up in the black market. I'm wondering, because, you know, when you think of many drugs, they can be laced. Even something like cannabis can be laced. I'm wondering, is that something people should be concerned about with, specifically with mushrooms in the black market? Can they be laced?
Yeah, so I guess they could be. I don't know if that would... I've never heard of this happening. And typically, you know, mushrooms are, like, in the black market, they're sold as whole fruiting bodies of the mushroom. So the actual, like, you know, the mushroom bit. So I guess you could find something and spray it onto those mushrooms and create a some sort of contamination or whatever. But yeah, I think that the risk there is pretty low, just because the way that mushrooms are grown and the cost of growing mushrooms is so low that I don't think you could add anything, you know, it would just make the product more expensive.
Gotcha.
But yeah, so not to say that can't happen in the future, you know, as we get more and more use, especially, you know, society is using it more and more, right? So as we get more and more of that use, maybe this will come along. But my hope is that, you know, the people that are growing the mushrooms have at least a respect for the plant that they, or the fungus, I guess, in this case, that they don't adulterate it.
Yeah. I mean, I hope so too. I'm curious about that, mostly because I know people do like to mix things, and I imagine eventually someone's going to go, well, you know, X number of people would like to mix mushrooms and some other thing. Why don't we try and combine the two in some way so that it's easier to ingest and you're not ingesting two separate things? But, you know, I'm not interested in doing that myself, and I'm hoping that doesn't happen, at least not without consent. But yeah, I'll leave that to people who feel like doing that out there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, you're right. I mean, even in Vancouver here, we've got three or four stores now that you can go in and buy mushrooms, and they have a whole bunch of, like, they've got drinks and they've got, chocolates, and they've got, like, caps, like, mushrooms encapsulated and stuff. So as those differentiated products, you know, the offerings expand, it probably leaves more and more opportunity for that. But I share your sentiment. Like, I'm okay with taking more than one drug at a time, but I want to know, I want to consent to it before I do that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this has been an incredible conversation, Ivan. Thank you so much for joining us. Do you have any final thoughts that you'd like to leave us with?
My final thought is the future is bright, and you know, I think psychedelics have a potential to, you know, to radically alter the trajectory of our society. We have a long way to go to have these compounds accepted and utilized to their maximum potential. But I think that we're now in a place in society where that's, you know, that definitely has a chance of happening. So yeah, just to all your listeners, just you know, stay positive about psychedelics. Learn everything you can. They're extraordinary tools for all a plethora of things that ail human society. So yeah, it's an extraordinary time to be alive.
Fantastic. The future is bright. That's a great way to close this off.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure chatting with you. Future is bright.